Hello. You all have bodies. You're more than just heads, right? Talking heads. Welcome home. Welcome back. It's really, really wonderful to have you here again. Filling this place with your energy, your presence. Thank you for showing up. It's an act of generosity to make the effort. Both two paramitas, generosity and effort, to make the trip here, to show up. It takes effort, and it's an act of kindness, of generosity to share the practice, to support other people's practice, and to give life to this place. So, good to see you all. The title for today's talk, The Path Ends in the Parsley. Strange title. But it refers to the path that one takes if one visits a monastery, whether it be a Japanese monastery or a Chinese monastery. There is a path that you take through that landscape. And when you approach the monastery, first there are these massive stone steps. This is a sort of a typical monastic temple community. And you have to go up these massive steps and pass through perhaps some very large ornamental pillars on either side of the main gate. And the main gate is also massive, very highly ornamented, carved. Sometimes there are these two what are called Garuda dogs, guardians of the temple. And so it's very impressive, very formal. And you enter through the main gate, through the temple doors. And then there is this huge space, ancient. It feels ancient, and it is ancient. It's almost mystical, the sacred quality of that space. And there are many different places in this temple. There is a place for worship. There is a hall for lectures. There is a place for sacred relics, that an artwork. And so there are many different spaces that you can visit, but it's all very grand, simple, but really elegant. And then you pass through the main temple, and you can exit the back door, the exit gate. And after you've exited that gate, you come upon usually the abbot's quarters, usually an abbot, not an abbess. but we're going to change that. So, and that's also very, very impressive, old and very elegant. And then there are the monks' quarters, all of the small cottages that surround the abbot's residence. Beyond those monks' quarters, there are the places where the staff lives, the gardeners, the cooks, and they are in a even more modest area. And then after that, there are usually some formal gardens. And after that, there are more informal gardens. Maybe there are gardens that serve the kitchen. But as you continue your path through this community, this sacred community, where does it end? It ends in the parsley, in the wild parsley that grows in the forest. And so why do I bring this monastic metaphor today? Because I want to make a point about the connection between what is done in the temple, which is so sacred, massive, impressive, ancient, with the mundane, with the parsley. Parsley is a very ordinary herb. Some people might not say that. They might consider it an extraordinary herb, but typically it grows in the wild, it's hardy, and it's ordinary. It's not like what's an extraordinary herb?
Saffron.
Right? Or so parsley is, you can count on parsley, but it's very mundane. So there is this seamless connection between this sacred place and this ordinary, wild, uncultivated parsley. And so what I want to begin to explore with you is the connection between what we do here in this temple and the parsley of your life, the ordinary everyday life that you live. There is a deep connection between what we do here in this temple and what you do in your everyday life. So what do we do in this temple that is connected to your ordinary life? What happens here? What transpires here? Well, as we've done already this morning, we bow. We light incense. We play the han. We play the drum. We strike bells. We walk in a certain way. We sit in a certain way. We chant. We do all of these things in a certain way. We call these our forms. The way we bow, the way we chant, the way we light incense, the way we light a candle, the way we put out a candle, the way we ring a bell, the way we strike the mokugyo, the way we sit a certain way, the way we race around during the second bell of kinhin. We do this all in a certain way. These are our forms, the forms that our practice takes, as well as, and we'll get eventually to zazen, which is the core practice, but our forms, all of these other things that we do, are really part of the practice and very, very significant. They're not disconnected from zazen, from our practice life, from our ordinary life. So some people ask, why do we need these forms? Why do we need all these, this rigmarole that we do, chanting and bowing and bell ringing and standing in a certain way, shashu, the mudras? There are a million different ways in which you can do that wrong. There are a million different ways in which you can make mistakes and be called upon and be noticed. So why? Why not just come in and sit down and shut up and just sit here? Why do we need all this other stuff? Well, if you actually pay attention, you'll discover that it really is not that easy just to come in here and sit down. These cushions aren't your living room couch. They're not your recliner. They're not even the chairs at your table. It is not the place where you can just come in and sit down. These things are not terribly comfortable. So this whole place is designed. It's actually a very artificial place. It's a very artificial construction, this whole place. You're not going to find this kind of place. Maybe anywhere else in Center County, I'm not sure. So it's really an unusual place. And it's designed to create a certain kind of experience. Not your so-called ordinary experience. It's a temple. And a temple is designed in such a way as to support and encourage a certain kind of experience. And the experience that we're cultivating, we're supporting, we're encouraging, is, well, it can be described in many ways. But let's just call it the experience of awakening. Of being fully awake and aware and attentive and present to your life. It's designed to help us do that, to awaken. So, I want to compare how this place is designed, because some people really have an objection to form, to all this rigmarole that we have to conform to. We have to conform to our forms. And I'd like to compare what we do here to help you notice that your life is full of forms of all sorts. For example, let's say you are preparing to go out to dinner at a very fine restaurant. And you're going to know the food is going to be superb. It's going to be wonderful. And the atmosphere is going to be fabulous. You naturally, right, would wear good clothes. You're not going to go to the fine restaurant in a bathing suit, for instance, or in your work clothes. You're going to sort of dress properly. And you might bring, if you were dining, for example, at a colleague's house, at a formal dinner, even at a friend's house or a colleague's house, you might bring some flowers. Similarly, you wouldn't bring like a suitcase into a fine restaurant. You wouldn't bring a lot of paraphernalia with you. It would be relatively, you'd be elegant, you'd be well-dressed. And similarly, if you were going to a fine restaurant, you'd probably have a reservation. And you'd be on time. you'd be on time for that reservation. And if you were having dinner at a colleague's house and the dinner was for 7 o'clock, you'd arrive, maybe a little early, but you'd be on time. You would not make a grand entrance into the restaurant or in when everybody else was sitting at the table, and then you're entering and you're late and you make a big fuss about your telling all kinds of excuses, and maybe not. Maybe you just call attention to your arrival. If the place was crowded, if you had to, you'd wait patiently to be seated or to be served. At a friend's house or a colleague's house or at a restaurant, you would not complain loudly. You wouldn't emphasize how hungry you were and how important it was that you be served first. You wouldn't put yourself in front of all of the other guests. So if the meal wasn't to your liking, maybe it wasn't as tasty as you thought it would be, maybe the guests were boring, you would probably tolerate the situation. Here you are in this fancy restaurant or at someone's home. You would be unlikely, if you were at somebody's home and the food wasn't to your liking, you wouldn't tell the cook, "Here, bring this back to the kitchen. It's not to my taste." You would be respectful and polite to others. You'd be respectful to the waiters, the cooks, if the cook happened to come out, the chef. And you'd be, I have to remember my father. We were very poor. And every now and then, we would go out to a restaurant. Very rarely. But my father made it a point, just because we were so poor, to have a wad of dollar bills that thick. And he would make it a point to show this. First of all, he when he made the reservation, he would call himself Dr. Lax. And he was not a doctor, he was a cab driver. But he wanted to pretend that he was more important than he was. That's a kind of pretentiousness that I suspect most of us. I was always terribly embarrassed when my father did this, you know, making a show of his inflated ego. So that's something we would not call attention to ourselves in that kind of conceited way. Well, clearly, I'm kind of suggesting here, in more than a subtle way, that some of the same sorts of forms and protocols apply here. The same sorts of forms that we engage in all the time, from very small ones to just the way we set the table, to major celebrations that have certain elements and rituals and processes that we go through. So clearly, when we come to practice here, we don't wear bathing suits. We don't wear clothing that calls attention to ourselves. Bright colors or messages. We dress modestly. Because one of the things that we are encouraging is when we speak about conforming, we are reducing the attention that is given to the separate self. When you conform, you're less likely to show up, to shine, to call attention to yourself. And so conforming sometimes is appropriate, especially if you are trying to cultivate a certain kind of experience, which is the experience of letting go of this separate self. And so you conform. You say, I'm going to obey the rules. That's often why in monasteries, in practice centers, everybody is wearing the same robe because they're not calling attention to themselves. Being on time. It's interesting, we call this a service. No. Be on time for the service. We're serving dinner at 7 o'clock. Be on time. Show up. Be respectful of other people's time. Wait patiently. So if you're not on time, in a restaurant, sometimes they have this place where you can sit, you know, and just wait till your table is ready or you're ready to be seated. So we have a library. If you come late, you sit there and wait patiently. Or if you go down to the restroom and have to come back during kinhin, you wait patiently, unobtrusively, by the door. Patience. Also, if you were at a fine restaurant, you would take care of the linens and the utensils and the beautiful wine glasses, and everything would be, you know, you wouldn't just make a big mess at your place, right? So similarly here, we don't throw the cushions around. We don't make a mess at our place, right? We take care of these practice elements. We don't just kind of toss the sutra books or just leave them kind of floating around. So again, if you had a guest in your house and they made a mess after all the preparations you made for them, that would be unacceptable. And so many of things that we do here, taking care of things, treating things with respect, with honor, is absolutely connected with what you do out in the parsley. So I found, for example, I conduct ceremonial tea periodically. And my practice of how to hold a cup or how to hold a bowl or how to hold a utensil has absolutely translated into the way I pour my tea in the morning. It's a very different kind of experience than just, you know, slapping some water in, you know, throwing the mindlessly. So we bring this kind of awareness to our forms so that we can bring this awareness into our lives. The impulse to rebel to disrespect or refuse to conform, I don't regard myself as a conformist. I can consider myself a rebel. And for a long time, I refused. I did not want to conform. And you can see I'm not conforming to the typical dress of a transmitted Zen priest. So I have my little rebel actions that I don't subscribe to total conformity. It is a way of calling attention to yourself. You're different. You're not going to behave like everybody else. But when you do conform, when you do take that seriously and engage in the forms wholeheartedly, you let go. You have to let go of your personal preferences. I don't feel like bowing. I don't like the way I have to hold my hands in this mudra. I want to come in when I feel like coming in and go out when I feel like going out. When you choose to conform, you are placing the sangha, the communal experience, over your personal preferences. That we usually move through the world, I like this, I don't like that, this should be like that, this should not be that. I'm the producer, director, and star of the show, and the world will be as I direct it to be. When you come here, it's different. You have to do a lot of things. Well, you don't have to, but you've chosen to do a lot of things that might really irritate you. So you have a choice as to how you want to relate to these forms. One possible response, which I've had experienced here, was, I'm not going to. I'm just not gonna do this. And when that happens, it's bye-bye. Go find another place. Go find another sangha, or don't find a sangha at all, because usually you'll find that there are forms in every Dharma center that you have to conform to. But if you don't want to, go. Have a good life. May your life go well. Or your attitude might be, okay, I'll do it, because you're making me do it. Only because you're making me do it. And the attitude toward those of us who have invited you to conform to the forms can be regarded as a very mean-spirited tyrant. You will put your hands in shashu. You will walk this way. Or, you're such a nitpicker. Every little thing you notice that I'm, you know, you're a sourpuss. You just like to pick on the mistakes that people make. Or, like, you're just an emotionless robot. You're just watching everything and making sure everybody just behaves in the same way. And you're just like a machine watching things without having any compassion for our tendency to make mistakes. So you can have an attitude of, I don't care one way or the other. It's like, I'm surrendering mindlessly, whatever. Whatever you want, I'll just do it. Well, that's not an attitude that supports an awakened being. It's going into a kind of mindless state. And that's not what we're about. Then there is, okay, no problem. I'll do it. I'll just do these things. It's a kind of surrender. That also is a kind of casual, unthinking, unemotional response. But then, you know, you could choose to embrace these forms. Why? Because you feel connected to these sacred ancient rituals, which unifies our Sangha, that we do these things together for the sake of supporting one another in our path to awakening, that when we observe these forms wholeheartedly, not because you're making me, because whatever, because I have to do that if I want to come here, but because as you participate in these forms, the Sangha becomes one body, one mind, one heart. We do this, we chant together, we recite together, we bow together, we sit together, we walk together. And so we welcome the opportunity to let go of our personal preferences and to be open to joining something beyond ourselves. And that's what these forms represent. But let me not forget that these forms are empty. If you ask me, why are we standing like this? Why are we sitting like this? Why are we lighting incense? Why are we doing full prostrations? I would have to say, I don't know. No reason. There's no intrinsic value or worth or meaning to any of these things that we do. Just as there's no intrinsic meaning to the way you set the table. Why? And that's what makes them so precious, so beautiful, that they're basically useless. We just do them. To do them and do them wholeheartedly with everything that we've got. How many things do we do in our lives that have this kind of wonderful emptiness, which are useless? Where most of the things, well, what can I get out of this? Or where is this going to take me? Or what's the practical value of this? There's no practical value to my holding this kotsu, first holding it like this and holding it like that. It's just a stick. It's parsley, but it's also 40 years of practice in this stick. So too, we are all experiencing another one of our forms, which is the Dharma talk. You're all sitting so quietly and so politely, listening to this fool, trying to transmit teachings that can only really be transmitted where the parsley grows. I thank you very much for tolerating this and being so polite about it.